Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program showcasing the stories and radio productions of this and many other community stations across the country. I'm Dory Smith of WHUS in Storrs, Connecticut.
I'm the local prosecutor. I'm the district attorney. I'm the one who, when Davis shot the police officer, I invoked the death penalty in court, and I was lead counsel in the prosecution of the case at the trial level.
On October 19th, Savannah, Georgia DA Spencer Lawton told readers of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against Troy Davis on hearing his appeal, the case was over and he could try to tell his side. Lawton was the lead prosecutor in the Davis case after his 1989 arrest for the murder of police officer Mark Allen McPhail. As it turned out, Lawton was wrong about the case being over. On October 24th, the 11th Circuit Court in Georgia agreed to consider another appeal from Davis, who has been on death row 17 years. He was scheduled to be executed at 7 p.m. on the 27th, and the 40-year-old has come within days or hours of being executed three times. Attorney Deirdre O'Connor has remained in close touch with Troy Davis. She wrote an amicus brief for the 2007 Georgia Supreme Court appeal in support of the defense.
They're going to give defense lawyers 15 days to submit a brief on their arguments as to why the 11th Circuit should grant permission for them to file this habeas petition that they have filed. Then the AG's office has 10 days to respond with their arguments as to why the attorney should not be allowed to file their petition. There's a pretty strict standard for being able to file a second habeas petition, and that is the challenge that the defense will have is to be able to persuade the court that this case merits a second review.
And with Herrera, the U.S. Supreme Court more or less opening the door on the question of innocence without going through it.
In Herrera, the Supreme Court assumed without deciding that in the rare case that there is a freestanding claim of innocence. In other words, if a person could present evidence so compelling that it provides clear proof of innocence, then certainly there would be an Eighth Amendment bar as cruel and unusual punishment to execute a person like that. Davis's lawyers are asking for the court to decide that issue. Is there a constitutional protection of the innocent not to be executed? And if so, under the 14th Amendment, what type of procedural due process is someone with a claim of innocence entitled to? How will somebody who's in a situation where they're innocent, they've been wrongfully convicted, what is the procedure that they can avail themselves to so that they can have their evidence of innocence heard in a court of law? And then the position, obviously, is that by having a categorical exclusion of the only kind of evidence you could have of innocence in a case like this amounts to a denial of due process. The irony here is that if Mr. Davis had a case that had biological evidence, and back in 1989 the testing was less sophisticated and it implicated him. Well, if in 2007 the more recent advancements in science allowed for more sophisticated tests, which is the case in DNA, that testing has evolved over time, and you could use it now to show that he was, in fact, not the perpetrator, he would be entitled to a new trial based on that.
Which court now gets that question?
It would go back to the district court for them to consider the claims of innocence under Herrera. The Herrera case is a U.S. Supreme Court decision that left open the question as to whether or not the Eighth Amendment prohibits the execution of an innocent person. And so the lawyers have filed a brief putting that question to the court with all of the evidence that supports Mr. Davis's innocence. They're asking the court to decide that this evidence meets the standard set out in Herrera.
Now, who is representing Troy Davis in all of this at this point?
Troy Davis is being represented pro bono by lawyers at Arnold & Porter. It's a Washington, D.C. firm. The issue that they've presented to the court in the petition that they filed, from an objective standpoint, is, I believe, is very compelling evidence of innocence, where they lay out all of the problems with the original trial testimony and the inherent unreliability of that testimony, and then discuss the overwhelming evidence that has come forward in the years since his post-conviction and demonstrate why it is that the court should, at the very least, conduct an evidentiary hearing with respect to those witnesses to determine whether or not there is a reason to go, to have a new trial. I mean, this court, by issuing the stay, has opened the door for Mr. Davis to finally have his evidence of innocence heard, and that has been a challenge for the defense to accomplish in the years that they've been trying to have that happen. So I am optimistic. Of course, whenever there's any opportunity for the court to correct its denial of this compelling evidence of innocence.
During an interview about the case, Spencer Lawton downplayed this evidence, claiming it was too much of a coincidence that 7 of 9 trial witnesses have recanted and another 9 witnesses have come forward implicating another man, Sylvester Red Coles, in the shooting.
It's such an uncanny coincidence as to invite the suspicion that it wasn't merely coincidence, at least in my mind, and I know in the minds of many others.
If you've said that they're not credible, can you just say why not? Is it the case that mistakes are so
seldom? What am I saying is not credible?
Well, you said it was suspicious. Suspect.
Well, yeah, sure.
You know, a couple things I remember. One was a man named Larry Young. He was hit in the head, and he told CBS News he never saw Troy Davis. And so he obviously is one of those who recants his testimony, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember him?
He was hit in the head. Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Give me the best reason that you can think. I just got through saying that these witnesses, when they testified at trial, they did so contemporaneously with the prosecution while their memories were relatively fresh. They did it under oath. They did it in open court. They did it subject to cross-examination by the defense attorneys who were trying to get them to say what they now say. Now, if we can think of one reason why what they say in their affidavits should be given any more credibility than what they said at trial, I would like to know what that reason is. Could you give me that reason?
Sure. What about the threat of incarceration for 10 to 12 years?
I don't understand you.
Some of these witnesses have said that they were threatened with being incarcerated for between 10 to 12 years.
Why? I'm asking you, why should we believe that? Why should we believe anything they say now more than we believe what they said when they were at trial?
Attorney Deirdre O'Connor directs Innocence Matters. She says the witnesses did tell the court they had been coerced at the time of the original trial.
When the prosecutor was trying to get him to implicate Mr. Davis, Mr. Collins said, "Listen, these things that I said to the police weren't true. I said them because they threatened me. They told me that they would put me in jail, that I would be charged with a crime." Here's some quotes. He said, "I told the detective what he wanted to hear because I was scared. I didn't want to go to jail. The police told me if I didn't cooperate with them, I'm going to be in prison for 10 to 12 years. But this was testimony provided in his presence to the jury in his case in which he was the lead attorney.
During an appeal hearing in 2007, the Georgia Supreme Court heard an assistant DA named Locke admit that there were witnesses who tried to back up at trial who said they had been coerced by police into signing statements.
There were some witnesses that backed up a little bit at trial. They were cross-examined on whether the police coerced them. Some said, yeah, the police just wanted me to sign the statement. But you know, that's the most police coercion we've really heard. Even alleged in the affidavits that, oh, they wanted me to sign the statement. They told me what to say.
Ultimately, Lawton argued that the courts had rules, and those rules had prevented the new evidence from being reviewed.
It's not me that's not allowing them, ma'am. It's the courts that aren't allowing them, and the reason they're not being allowed is because there are rules that say when something is allowed and when it's not, and they don't meet the rule.
The Georgia Supreme Court was divided 4-3 on the question of whether or not rules Lawton was referring to should prevent new evidence for innocence from coming to light. By one vote, the court followed precedent, requiring Davis's defense to establish proof that witnesses were lying during the original trial. Attorney Ezekiel Edwards of the Innocence Project explained.
Georgia Supreme Court has basically said that unless you can come in with some sort of extrinsic evidence that this person could not have been telling the truth, they were convicted of perjury, they were not in the state at the time, we're not even going to hear what you have to say. And I think what's so disturbing is that the Georgia Supreme Court's decision on recantations is reversible. The Supreme Court could look at that and decide that that standard is too severe. The Board of Pardons and Paroles in Georgia, their decision not to grant Troy Davis clemency, that's reversible. Obviously, these are just man-made decisions that can be reversed. But executing Troy Davis, that isn't reversible. And that certainly will bring finality, but it's a finality I don't think our country or our system of criminal justice wants, aside from what one feels about the death penalty, in the face of compelling evidence of innocence in a case that at the very least raises reasonable doubts as to Troy Davis's guilt. And he hasn't even had the opportunity to present that evidence in kind of a comprehensive fashion in a court of law.
Attorney Thomas Ruffin Jr. of Washington, D.C., noted problems with witnesses during Spencer Lawton's trial of Troy Davis.
During the course of the trial, there was evidence that some of these witnesses were giving totally inconsistent testimony. Like, for example, Ms. Dorothy Farrell. She said one thing during the pretrial hearing. She said something else during trial. If I'm not mistaken, she said something altogether different in her police statement. And then on top of all of that, she said something totally different in the affidavit that she provided at the trial. After she testified in trial, she started telling some of her friends that she regretted her testimony wherein she identified Troy Davis as the killer. She told her friends that she didn't see the killing, and, you know, she really felt bad. She didn't know what to do. And she worried because she was on parole, and she believed that if she revealed the truth, that her parole would be revoked. The man who was beaten in the parking lot before the police officer was shot, he had very serious injuries. The defense lawyers never interviewed him, never even tried to question him. Actually, never interviewed Dorothy Farrell until she took the stand. Never interviewed Troy Davis's friend who lied on the witness stand and claimed that Troy Davis confessed to the murder. They didn't interview any of the witnesses.
One of Davis's more recent attorneys, attorney Kathleen Behan of Washington, D.C., also noted problems with his original defense, saying he would have had little chance to win on early appeals.
In 1995, the Georgia Resource Center was handling this case, and they were overwhelmed, and they had had their funding cut off, and they were working on numerous cases. And so they proceeded by affidavit, and that was not the ideal situation, and they knew it at the time. They had to essentially triage men on death row. And that's exactly what they did. And it was of no fault of their own. It was a federal mandate to cut off Resource Center funding. That mandate placed upon well-meaning people working for next to nothing for men on death row is being used against the men on death row so that, and I can quote you the affidavit, during the period of September 1995 through 1997, only two attorneys at the Staff Resource Center in Georgia were representing 113 men on death row, and they would file skeletal state habeas corpus petitions. They were boilerplate, and they were done in order to preclude an execution from happening. And what they sought to do was to keep men alive while they could get resources in order to properly represent these men. One of those men was Troy Davis, and it was apparent to everybody that has worked on this case, including me, that Troy Davis had a very strong claim for actual innocence.
Attorney Behan, what about Spencer Lawton's argument that this evidence the defense is now trying to present has already been reviewed by courts, judges, and as he put it, they found it wanting?
Now, the notion that judges have reviewed this on the evidence is simply not true. Trial lawyers understand that until you get the witnesses into a court of law and they're cross-examined and they're allowed to air their views, and particularly in a case where there's been allegations that the witnesses were pressured by the prosecution and they're allowed to explain the impact of that pressure, the judge, who has the onerous task of having to decide this case, would have to see those witnesses in person. That's what's been debated many years about this case.
Another witness who has recanted trial testimony, Tanya Johnson, says she saw the real killer of Officer McPhail run from the crime scene and hide a gun.
She said that she was out front on the porch of her duplex, and she saw Sylvester Coles and another man whom she knew. She identified the man, said it clearly wasn't Troy Davis, walked to the vacant home next to hers and hide a gun there and then go away, and then after a while return and take the gun and go away. So she confessed that she never revealed that information. She said that she was scared of this man, Sylvester Coles, who had a reputation for violence.
Many witnesses place Sylvester Red Coles at the scene of all three violent acts that took place on the night of the McPhail killing. I asked Savannah D.A. Spencer Lawton if he had ever investigated Sylvester Red Coles.
Yes. Well, I don't know what you're going to be willing to call an investigation, but what happened is he came, I think it was the day after the event. He produced himself to the police. I think maybe I had said this in the material you're looking at.
Well, you made the point that he had an attorney, but his attorney allowed him to appear before the police without his being present. Why was that important?
Well, because it indicates some confidence on the part of the lawyer that Coles was not involved. Any lawyer who had even the tiniest notion that his client could be tied to the case, whether justifiably or not, would never allow him to testify without counsel presence. So, or make a statement to the police without counsel presence. So, what that really basically indicates is that the man's own lawyer was sufficiently confident that he could not be tied to it, that he told him go down there, go to the police station, and tell him anything. They tell him whatever it is that you know that you got to say. So he did.
So that, in fact, is why you didn't investigate Coles. I mean, isn't that kind of an assumption on your part, or did you ask the lawyer?
Oh, gee, everything's an assumption at some point.
Troy Davis's present attorney is Jason Ewert of Arnold & Porter in Washington, D.C., who has said his case is one of reasonable doubt and innocence. Ewert is putting together another habeas corpus appeal to the 11th Circuit Court in Georgia, hopeful that there will finally be a new hearing to review evidence. 130 people have been exonerated from death row in America. 6 were in Georgia. 3 were in D.A. Spencer Lawton's district. And the D.A. has some other reasons to be defensive about the Davis case and others like it. If a court does hear new evidence, it may include testimony from witnesses who say they were coerced into telling police and judges what they wanted to hear. Time has not softened his view that Davis should have been executed immediately.
If the state says it's going to impose a penalty on you, then it ought to just do it. It oughtn't to hang around in the wings, messing around with it for a decade and a half or something approaching 2 decades.
Troy Davis's sister, Martina Correa, has been fighting to keep her brother alive. She went through Lawton's statements, noting gross errors.
Despite the fact that the district attorney is just spouting all kind of untruth and putting parts of the truth and adding to, you know, the truth, it's just really amazing because I think people see that for what it was. Because, you know, I had someone ask me about certain things that are going on, and I say to them that we are fighting very hard to get the truth heard, not just for Troy, but for Officer McPhail.
Martina Correa, what about Spencer Lawton's comments on Sylvester Red Coles?
Sylvester Red Coles, the chief, you know, witness against Troy for the prosecution, he testified that he threw away his gun. The police also said that Troy assaulted Larry Young, the homeless man that was being attacked that night. And in the trial transcript, Sylvester Coles testified that he was the one arguing with Larry Young over the can of beer. He was the one arguing with him. And then he ran away and threw away his gun. That's Sylvester Coles' testimony. That's the eyewitness testimony. And then he told about how he went with a lawyer to the police department because he wanted to tell what happened. So their own witness and his police statement and his records, his testimony at trial and the next day would actually just blow out of the water everything Spencer Lawton has said.
Chatham County, Georgia has developed a reputation for errors and other problems with capital murder trials. That's why people on various sides of the death penalty now agree there should be a moratorium on executions in the state. In November of 1991, Gary Nelson was released from prison after spending 11 years protesting his innocence. And in 1989, the same year Troy Davis was arrested, another Georgia man, James Williams, was finally released after Georgia's Supreme Court confirmed that the district attorney in the case, none other than Spencer Lawton, had failed to present important evidence that could have been used at the time of the trial to clear Williams. The Williams case became the subject of a best-selling book on Chatham County titled Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil by John Berendt. Clint Eastwood turned the book into a popular film.
All rise.
You know, of course, that no one's ever going to really know what happened.
True story and deliciously evil, don't you think?
Do you want to tell me what really happened that night?
Truth, like art, is in the eye of the beholder.
In the true-to-life story, James Williams was released after establishing self-defense as an argument for innocence. Troy Davis has always insisted he didn't shoot Officer Mark McPhail. Ultimately, four jurors in Troy Davis's trial signed statements swearing that they wouldn't have sentenced Davis to death if the evidence available today had been presented at his trial. Attorney Ezekiel Edwards is an expert in the field of eyewitness identification.
When witnesses come to court and testify at trial and identify somebody and point their finger and say, that's the person in front of 12 jurors, that's, first of all, very compelling evidence when the witness is confident and sure of their identification. And it really sways jurors to believing that witness. The problem is that that testimony, first of all, often occurs months, if not years, after the incident. And between the incident when they actually allegedly saw something and when they come to trial to testify, there are many factors that can affect both their memory for the incident and also their confidence in that identification. Jurors don't often understand that. And so cross-examination, although a very useful mechanism to get at the truth in many instances, is far from enough in many eyewitness cases, even if you have a good defense lawyer who's doing his job, which, if you look at the Troy Davis case, I feel like the defense was quite inadequate. First of all, the lawyer didn't actually even try to keep this evidence, the identification evidence, out of court. He didn't even make a suppression motion. There was no identification expert called to educate the jury about factors that affect identification reliability. There weren't any special jury instructions given by the court to the jurors to sensitize them to this kind of testimony. But even on top of that, cross-examination alone is not going to get you very far with an honest, but let's say mistaken, eyewitness.
The two police witnesses that have not recanted their testimony at trial are Sylvester Red Coles and Stephen Sanders. Sanders was ordering food at a drive-thru window, the restaurant where McPhail was shot in the parking lot. And Sanders told police at the time of the shooting he couldn't see the perpetrator's face from where he was. 2 years later, he identified Troy Davis at trial. Are you saying Troy Davis's original defense team, not the ones he has now, could possibly have suppressed his testimony?
Well, yeah, and there are a couple things that you bring up. The witness that you talked about, from my understanding, was actually had two opportunities, one very close to the time of the crime and one about a month later, to make an identification, and he couldn't. And that was even after Troy Davis's picture had been kind of all over the news. And then 2 years later comes to court with confidence and says that that was the person. And so that's obviously highly suspect. And one of the many reforms that we advocate is when a witness is not only to preserve all that evidence, what photos are shown and what identifications and non-identifications are made, but also whenever somebody makes any kind of an identification, that they're asked to basically give a certainty statement in their own words about how certain they are in their identification prior to getting any kind of feedback from the police or the media. I think a much more problematic instance in this case that you bring up is the fact that every witness who identified Troy Davis in a lineup had been exposed to his picture prior to the lineup, and uniquely to his picture. Some had been exposed to it on a wanted poster. Some had seen it on the news. Somebody had actually seen a photo, I think, in the possession of the police, I think in a police car, prior to the actual procedure. And both common sense and social science dictate that if you're exposed to somebody's photograph prior to a lineup, not only does it sometimes replace the image or whatever memory you have of the actual perpetrator, it also makes it very likely that when you're then presented with a group of people, none of whom you've seen before except for this one photo, that that's a person that you're going to pick out, and that's a person you're probably going to suspect must be who the police have as their main culprit.
Ezekiel Edwards is staff attorney at the Innocence Project, where they note 223 cases of wrongful convictions. In light of their work and the work of many other legal research teams, states are imposing moratoriums on the death penalty. Even Texas lawmakers who once presented a brick wall against the idea that an innocent man could be put on death row have softened their position. Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Office in Washington, D.C., agreed that many cases of wrongful conviction involve faulty eyewitness identification.
There have been a lot of exonerations, and some of them through DNA, but what caused the mistake in the first place wasn't DNA, it was something like a faulty eyewitness. People with the best of intentions sometimes say, they look at some pictures of suspects and they say, I think it was him. That's a sketchy science at best, and it, you know, faulty eyewitness is one of the main reasons for wrongful conviction. So it's, I think there's every reason to believe that a mistake could have been made in this case, and now we have not one but multiple witnesses who have said that, you know, they were pressured. They simply would not have pointed to Troy Davis at this point. That's a lot of change. That's why I think this case is so unusual. Not one witness, it's seven.
That's it for Sprouts. We heard from Savannah, Georgia DA Spencer Lawton. He's retiring this year, and his assistant, David Locke, is running for his job. Attorneys Deirdre O'Connor, director of the group Innocence Matters, Thomas Ruffin of Washington, D.C., he's with the Nat Turner Rebellion, Kathleen Kitty Behan, one of Troy Davis's previous attorneys, Ezekiel Edwards is staff attorney with the Innocence Project in New York and was an investigator at the Capitol Defender's Office in Manhattan, working on behalf of people facing the death penalty. Richard Dieter is with the Death Penalty Information Office. Again, on October 24th, the 11th Circuit Court in Georgia agreed to review another habeas corpus appeal that could save Troy Davis's life. For further information, go to the website freetroydavis.com. I'm your host, Dori Smith of WHUS in Storrs, Connecticut. Sprouts is distributed and coordinated by Pacifica Radio Network, thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast to showcase it nationally, contact Air Traffic Controller Ursula Rudenberg at ursula@pacifica.org. That's URSULA at pacifica.org. This week's show was produced at WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. In addition to our theme music for Sprouts, we also heard Black Note Soul. Yeah, 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 yeah.